Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing Podcast.
That program is what right now is kind of what we're focused on, most proud of. There's all kinds of things going on around that, right? Like the precision management, we've done a bunch of research on the lower Henry's Fork and looking at, you know, how to optimize flows there to protect not only the lower Henry's Fork, but protect Island Park Reservoir and the ranch. That was a whole PhD project. We've also done a PhD project above Island Park Reservoir, coming from Big Springs, which is the large spring that supplies most of the water to the Henry's Fork coming off that Yellowstone country.
That was Brandon Hoffner describing the most important work ongoing in the South Fork of the Snake. Find out who's keeping the water flowing in the Henry's Fork, plus a chance to win an all-expenses-paid trip to this area and some trout fishing today on the swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how you doing today? Thank you for stopping by the show. We are giving away a huge trip right now. It just went live. This is the trout giveaway. This is the Euro School giveaway, the Euro Nymphing School. We're heading to the Henry's Fork, the South Fork, the Snake, and any of the other rivers that are in between. And we are being guided by some of the best Euro Nymphers out there. And this is just going to be an amazing trip. You're going to join me on this adventure. We're going to have a private cabin. We're going to have an amazing chef. We got it all going here. So if you want to get involved in this, you can check in right now. Enter the giveaway, wetflyswing.com/giveaway right now for a chance to win. If you want to just go ahead and just buy one of the 6 slots we have available for this one, you can send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com. But you might as well enter the giveaway as well, because if you win, we would reimburse you for anything you paid up front. Hope to see you on the river and excited about this trip and the big Euro Nymphing School giveaway. Today's episode is sponsored by Eastern Idaho's Yellowstone Teton Territory, Idaho's most renowned zone for fly fishing. From the Henry's Fork to the South Fork of the Snake and all the high alpine lakes and streams in between, Yellowstone Teton Territory provides anglers and other outdoor enthusiasts with all the information they need to plan their next big trip. You can visit wetflyswing.com/Teton right now to get the full list of outfitters, lodges, fly shops, and all kinds of inspiration to get you started on your next trip to Eastern Idaho. That's Teton, T-E-T-O-N, wetflyswing.com/Teton. Brandon Hoffner is here to take us into one of the conservation groups leading the way on the Henry's Fork, South Fork and Snake in this amazing part of the country. We find out why water use is the number one topic Brandon is focusing on in his work. We discover which species they are also focusing on in some of these famous rivers in this part of the world. And also we get a little glimpse into how they are working and around these water rights and some of the big issues around water, which is always a very interesting topic, sometimes contentious. So Brandon sheds some really good light, has a good perspective on this. Okay, let's jump into this one and dig into the YCT and find out what keeps the foundation going strong. Here we go, Brandon Hoffner from Henry's Fork Foundation.org. How you doing, Brandon?
I'm doing great, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on here and chatting about the good stuff you guys have going out at the Henry's Fork Foundation. We're going to talk about this. We've got a big trip we're doing. We're doing a big giveaway this week, and we got a big trip coming up later in the year. And it's just a cool place. The Henry's Fork is one of those names, you know, like we've had a number of episodes with guests. I think we just had Craig Matthews on recently, and he was talking about it. Obviously, the guy with 1% for the Planet, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's a hot spot. How does it feel for you when you're sitting where you are? Does it feel like you're in kind of a mecca of fly fishing and in conservation too, because that's where you are?
Most definitely. You know, the history here, the names associated, the books written about the Henry's Fork, you know, back into the 60s and then on from there and to current day. Most definitely, it feels like a hotbed. It feels like mecca. It puts a microscope on our work, no doubt, too. So we see, you know, a lot of faces come through and celebrities, but in the fly fishing world, it's pretty cool. And people do know, as you travel around, people do know about the Henry's Fork, even if they've never been here.
Yeah, they do. And we're going to discuss some of the work you guys have going. And it's not just, I mean, you have the Henry's Fork, which is the name you hear, but also like the South Fork of the Snake, right? Which is another big name you hear about. Why do you think, you know, you guys are the Henry's Fork, why not the South Fork of the Snake? Is there another group kind of in that area, or, you know, why is it the Henry's Fork Foundation?
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to our history. There was a lot of concern about the Henry's Fork in the early 80s, whether it was, there were some changes in management at Harriman State Park. For folks that are familiar with the Henry's Fork, mostly the focus is the ranch, Harriman State Park. It was the Harriman family's ranch up through the 60s, then they gifted it to the state of Idaho. That is the piece of water, you know, the dry fly fishing PhD that everybody knows about, and that's what they focus on. Although the rest of the Henry's Fork is very productive and fabulous as well. If people haven't been here and they've been reading about it, normally they're reading about that ranch section. And so there was some changing in grazing practices as the transition from a private ranch to a state entity managed piece of property. And so we had some, you know, degradation of the banks. And so we had fencing projects. There was a proposal from folks that ran a power company to dam Mesa Falls and flood part of that stretch of water. There was all these threats at that time that the Henry's Fork Foundation was established to address. And so that's, you know, for many, many years, that's what we looked at. But information evolves. And so our roles evolved as we've learned more about the processes here on the Henry's Fork, whether it has to do with water quantity or water quality. You know, the funny thing is we work with Idaho Fish and Game, and we will go out electrofishing and help them with, you know, indexes of rainbow trout populations and so forth. But most of our work is about water, and it's water quantity and water quality. And the fish population, kind of, if we provide that habitat, you know, good quality habitat, they'll be there. And so, and then we'll see that in that work that Idaho Fish and Game does through their indexes and so forth. So the growth into the South Fork initiative really came about because you can't manage Island Park Reservoir, which is, we'll end up talking a bunch about in this podcast. It really drives the health of the fishery here on the Henry's Fork, but you can't manage Island Park Reservoir in a vacuum. It's part of an Upper Snake Reservoir system. And so having, you know, some, the influence of being on the South Fork definitely helps the Henry's Fork as well. Not to mention there was a group of people down there that saw our work, you know, the science, the peer-reviewed papers, the collaborative processes, the dedication to the Henry's Fork. And they said, hey, we would love to have you help us with that. So we have a committee down there that's working with us. And the nature of the work is a little different, but yet it is providing both a benefit to the South Fork, but definitely to the Henry's Fork as well. It gives us just a different ability to work with partners when it comes to water managers, those water managers looking at a bigger system than just the Henry's Fork.
Gotcha. Yeah. So it's more than just the Henry's Fork. And maybe you can describe that a little bit, just the, take us to, you know, not only your area, but talk about, make the connection, because the Henry's Fork is a trib to the South Fork of the Snake, right? And describe that, like, what is your area? And then describe the bigger picture for people that haven't been there, don't know what it looks like on a map.
You know, if you start in this Eastern Idaho, in this kind of Northeast portion of Eastern Idaho, you've got the caldera. It's a volcanic caldera coming off the Yellowstone, Yellowstone National Park and the Madison Plateau. So all this volcanic activity. And so the Henry's Fork is really a spring-driven system. Of course, at some point, you know, big snow melt events will impact it in some way. But overall, you can think of it as groundwater-dominated, spring-dominated system. Well, as you start to move south towards the Tetons, you hit Fall River and you start to see the, you know, a little more, it's still spring dominated and groundwater dominated, but Fall River, as a tribute to the Henry's Fork, has a little more impact from you know, snow melt in the spring, as far as the hydrology of that system. Well, then you move, you know, a little further south in the Tetons, and you hit the Teton River, another tributary of the Henry's Fork. These rivers I'm mentioning are also great fisheries, you know, for themselves. But yet the Teton ends up being even more flashy, right? That snow melt off the Tetons. Now there's still actually a spring component down there and a groundwater component based on the hydrology and geology of the Teton Basin and so forth. But it is definitely more snow melt driven. By the time you get to the South Fork, now you've switched kind of where it's there is some spring, you know, fed and groundwater influence coming out of Yellowstone National Park. But by and large, it is a snowmelt driven system and a much flashier hydrology on the South Fork. So now it curls around and heads back north and meets up with the Henry's Fork near Idaho Falls. And it's also a much larger system. But and then after they combine their forces, they head downstream through the Snake River Plain. And you hit American Falls Reservoir, which you can see on Google Earth, you know, this extremely large impoundment. But in southern Idaho, where we are here, you know, you've heard of the Idaho potatoes. Well, this is one of the largest irrigated agricultural systems in the entire world. And it's a massive industry and a massive part of Idaho's economy. And so there's a whole system of reservoirs on the Henry's Fork and the South Fork that contribute to being able to produce all of this food and the irrigated agriculture that goes along with it that started in the late 1800s. And so, yeah, it gets very complex with water rights and the policies that go around that. But, and that's kind of what I was saying, where the Island Park Reservoir, which is on the Henry's Fork, it's the oldest impoundment on the Henry's Fork, I believe, or it's the oldest one for water storage, I think, or maybe actually Henry's Lake is the oldest. They just increased the size of a lake, but you know, these are fairly old impoundments. They've been there a while, since the last 30s.
Yeah, when water rights began, or right, they were there. They've had their water rights for a while.
Yeah, and unlike some of the impoundments on the South Fork or the main snake, you know, the Henry's Fork, even though there's a management role for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, you know, it has a different set of mandates because of the way it started as a private impoundment. And yeah, it just has some different, it doesn't have the same fish and wildlife mandates and the law behind it that, say, some of the other federal facilities you'll see across the West have. So it is really about irrigation storage. It's, you know, it doesn't even really have a flood control mandate, to be honest with you. And part of that is due to the hydrology, but part of it's due to the way that it was started. So yeah, it's just a little bit different animal as far as reservoirs. It's also important to understand it's a big, it's not a deep V reservoir like you see in a lot of reservoirs in the West, where you get this, you know, huge amount of super cold water coming out of a deep reservoir. This is a big flat.
Oh, wow. Shallow.
Yeah, fairly shallow. Well, you know, there is a part that's a little deeper, but the whole west end of the reservoir, we're talking like 6,000 acres, is fairly shallow. And that contributes to some challenges when it comes to water quality and so forth.
Right. Gosh. So basically, sounds like water quality is the number one thing, and probably to a, you know, a certain extent, just the dams historically, right? Because you could look at, I mean, when you think South Fork Snake, you think, yeah, you hear the snake, but you don't probably think as much. But yeah, it flows down eventually into Hell's Canyon, right? And then into where there's more dams. And then how much is that a part of your thing, thinking about like the dams versus the water? Or is it the water that's just really the main thing that you focus on these days?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely think about the dams, but not in the way that a lot of groups would.
Yeah. Like you're not actively like, we need to remove all these dams. You're more focused on like water quality, water quantity.
Exactly. We're looking for those win-win situations in between the water managers, the egg producers, and, you know, the health of the fishery. We're trying to figure that out. And in fact, you know, while Island Park Reservoir can be a difficult, you know, issue for the Henry's Fork, it also provide some of the productivity that you experience on the Henry's Fork too, right? It has some positive benefits as well. And, you know, and then if you go to the South Fork and look at Palisades Dam, that definitely provides some, you know, that is more that deep V, you know, reservoir. And so, you know, consistent cold water.
Tailwater stuff.
Yeah. And then you kind of get that effect down there. And so, and honestly, the collaborative nature of our work, we don't see, there's not really a great benefit to be had by dam removal. And it just, we want to work with our partners here. There is this, you know, $10 billion ag economy in southern Idaho. We want to work with them to figure out how to make sure we have the most robust and healthy fishery within that we can. And that's kind of how the space we work in.
Yeah, That's a good take on it. Basically, yeah, that's one of those things, right? You definitely want to work together because there's a better chance of getting some good stuff done if everybody's at the table as opposed to people aren't at the table, right?
Most definitely. And when I first started here, there was a lot of talk about, well, let's start the lawsuits up.
Right.
And, yeah. And, you know, it's okay, go talk to some groups that want to do that. We're not going to be that group. And here's why. And really it was not only would it not, you know, be productive, it would cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And the water rights are tied up in the Idaho Constitution. I mean, this stuff is in a state water plan and these very, there's just, we're not going to necessarily change any of that. What we can change and what we can do is bring really good data to the table and ask for reasonable things and have influence because we're a trustworthy partner and our information is good. And we can ask for things that make sense and don't, it turns out a lot of it ends up being mutually beneficial. It just needs to be, we need the information there to show how it's mutually beneficial. And that takes an investment, that takes time and effort, and that takes an investment that luckily our members have been willing to make up to this point.
Gotcha. Nice. Well, talk about some of that. You mentioned the South Fork Initiative. Maybe give us a highlight on a few of the things that you're all spending your time on that are, you know, some things people can kind of get a little insight on what you're doing out there.
Yeah. So one of the things is looking at tributary restoration. That's probably one of our biggest focuses right now. So Rainy Creek is a tributary of the South Fork in Swan Valley, Idaho. And it actually, the Rainy Creek itself has tributaries as well that are, most of those tributaries are spring-fed tributaries. They're in the valley floor. And so we've been working on just, you know, it's suffered previously from solar loading, you know, warm water temperatures. So we've, you know, worked on narrowing that stream up, making it a little bit deeper. But you're talking like 8 miles. There's still some water management issues. So we're just now launching into multiple phases on Rainy Creek itself and some of the tributaries such as Third Creek, trying to make sure that we have, you know, the best habitat conditions available for Yellowstone cutthroat trout that are going to run up there to spawn. And we do that in conjunction with, you know, the U.S. Forest Service, Idaho Fish and Game, private landowners. Even one of those, you know, a piece of the land was developed and it now has condominiums around it. But luckily that piece of Rainy Creek looks a lot better than it ever did, you know, when it was in pasture, to be honest with you. It's a much better trout habitat than it was at one time. So, you know, just now starting to, we kind of were opportunistic when we started that. Where could we work? Who could we work with? And getting it rolling. And now we're getting a little more, yeah, a little more strategic about how we're doing and building an overall plan for Rainy Creek. So that's a big part of it. But then, you know, we're doing macroinvertebrate monitoring on the South Fork, you know, just building that baseline knowledge. What do the insect populations there look like and how are they changing over time? We find that to be very complementary to a lot of the kind of physical water quality monitoring, which is also something we're now doing on the South Fork and wasn't there before. We've got three different stations where we're looking at water quality parameters, dissolved oxygen, temperature, and so on. And just trying to get out ahead of any problems that might ever develop there, understand the system better. And, you know, at some point here in the future, we hope to build things like, you know, sediment load graphs and so forth, you know, understanding how that system's working and functioning and where the problems might be. So those are the main things we're working on right now.
Right on. So for species, you mentioned Yellowstone cutthroat. What are the main species you're focused on there when you think of like just kind of the fish? And it probably focuses on like the fishing, right? But there's probably some other species maybe that people aren't fishing for as much.
You know, of course, there is an issue on the South Fork as a stronghold of the Yellowstone cutthroat trout. And then rainbow trout moving in to the South Fork and their population increasing and interbreeding with Yellowstone cutthroat trout.
Oh, right.
So Idaho Fish and Game is working on that. They've been working on that issue for a long time, you know, looking at flows and, you know, spring flows to try and flush rainbows and allow YCT to compete at a better level. The brown trout population is growing there as well. Of course, mountain whitefish and many others. Our work ends up focusing on those, you know, sport related species, but in the end, it ends up helping out, you know, multiple species and, you know, honestly, the health of the entire river. That would be usually is the end result of, you know, better water quality, more water, those things.
Gotcha. So you don't have to focus on, you don't necessarily have to say, hey, these are, this project we're doing is for Yellowstone cutthroat. You can just say, like you said earlier, it's water quality and it's going to help everything, and let it, you know, there's probably going to be some natural variation, right, within those populations, even though there are invasive species out there.
You know, in the tributaries, there is definitely a focus by Idaho Fish and Game to make that a Yellowstone cutthroat trout area. And that's kind of what we're seeing. The tributaries, they've been successful at keeping those, many of the tributaries, as YCT strongholds in the main river.
How do they do that? How would you keep the tributaries? Or is this because there's dams restrict them? How do you keep the tribs strongholds and not let the rainbow get in there?
They use electrified weirs.
Oh, wow.
And they're able to capture the fish then. Amazing. And they remove the rainbows and then pass those Yellowstone cutthroat trout upstream. And they've had pretty good success with that, with their electrified weir system. So it works a lot, you know, just like electrofishing and so forth. So it does work. But yeah, in the main river, the different things that we've tried in the past, they've tried to have anglers keep rainbow trout to suppress the population. I think it's fairly well agreed now that, you know, unless there was some huge effort beyond what anyone's ever thought about, we're not getting rid of rainbow trout in the South Fork. There's always going to be some level of that population there. The problem has been is that it's just been constantly increasing to the point where it is very easy to see where YCT, you know, ceased to exist in the main fork of the South Fork. So they're trying to help them along with these programs, you know, angler take, which didn't really work. They put a bounty on them. You know, there's been some that's helped a little bit, but not enough, not to levels that are necessary. We tried spring-to-spring flushing flows, and we could never get it to the magnitude it needed to be. And honestly, part of that was, you know, people built along the banks of the river. And so you're going to end up flooding homes trying to get enough energy into the river. It's very difficult to get a historic, you know, flow regime on the South Fork of the Snake at this point.
Right. It's a tailwater, essentially. It is a tailwater.
It looks a lot more like that than it would have naturally. So,
yeah.
And you still get some high flows occasionally, but it's not near enough or often enough. And in fact, what turned out happening in that case is that the flows level we could get, which was somewhere around 20,000 cubic feet per second, maybe 21, 22. It was never up to the 24, 25,000 cubic feet per second it needed to be to actually move some substrate around in a real way. And it actually helped the rainbow trout. So we scrapped that. You're right. That's science for you. That's, you set some hypotheses, you try some things out, you do your research, and then you modify, you know, you're constantly modifying your knowledge base and working from that. And that's just kind of the scientific process. And in that case, that didn't work. And, you know, the reality is the situation, the politics around it, that's never going to work really. And so that now Idaho Fish and Game has, they've been working on rainbow reds in the spring, removing rainbow trout. And that's highly controversial, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's right. Cause rainbows get big. That's the thing about it. It's interesting because the, you know, browns are these cool, right? They get big. Rainbow can get really big, but cutthroat don't really get that big, right? Even if you have a lot of food, because they're just not that species. Like what would be a big, Yellowstone cutthroat you might catch?
Oh, well, I mean, I think it's probably different for different streams, right? But if you go into the headwaters of Yellowstone Lake, I've caught 28 inches there. And in fact, one of the...
You've caught how many? How big?
28 inch Yellowstone cutthroat trout.
Oh, wow. So there are giant cutthroat.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I was wrong. I'll take back my comment then. It sounds like there are giant cutthroat.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, if you caught a 20 incher on that trip, you were wondering what was wrong.
Holy cow, this is cool. So are the Yellowstone, that this is amazing. So then they are, I mean, this is a species for sure that can get big.
Oh yeah, and in fact, one of the guides at Henry's Fork Angler caught a cutthroat on the lower Teton that was 30 inches. There's been, you can definitely see them up to 32 inches, but to catch like a 24 inch cutthroat on the South Fork, entirely possible.
But when you're fishing out there, I mean, you could be fishing on the South Fork and all of a sudden you're whatever, nymphing or doing whatever. And all of a sudden you don't know what it is. It could be a brown, a rainbow, or a big cutthroat.
Oh, most definitely. And actually my wife's family has, you know, they fished on the South Fork pre Palisades Dam, right? They're from, they homesteaded that area. And they, you know, her grandfather just passed away, but he fished it since he was 10 years old. He was 99 years old when he passed away this year. Her dad's fished it for, you know, 50 some years now. And yeah, they just talk about when it was all cutthroat, just how amazing, you know, the size. And then they didn't know what they had then, right? There was nobody on the river and these huge fish. And so to hear those stories is pretty amazing. The one thing that makes unique, right, is that there's the Yellowstone where you can have a pretty cool dry fly fishery for YCT. And that's kind of the other cool thing about,
The Yellowstone.
Yeah. The South Fork's kind of the same way. It's not like it's the only remaining dry fly fishery, but as far as a Yellowstone cutthroat trout dry fly fishery, it's one of the remaining places to be able to do that. So it's a pretty cool deal. And of course it's always nice to then throw some streamers and you can catch big cutthroat doing that, big browns. But one of the best days on the South Fork is when the riffles are going, PMDs are hatching, and you can catch, you know, 13 to 20 inch cutthroat on a riffle all afternoon long during the PMD hatch. That's a lot of fun. I mean, that's good stuff.
That is cool. That's the interesting thing when we're coming in here, because we're doing this Euro nymphing school, right? And it is focused on Euro nymphing, and there you go, right? I mean, you can nymph too, right? People, I mean, probably maybe if they get the opportunities, they're fishing dries, but nymphing sounds like it's pretty effective. Do you see many people nymph fishing out there?
Oh yeah, most definitely, right? Sometimes it's the only game that's available to you, right? I guess I'm pretty adaptive. I'll do whatever it takes, you know, between streamer fishing, dry fly fishing, and nymphing.
Do you have have you gotten into Euro? You got the Euro game going?
No, I mean, it's kind of like why I don't play golf. And that's because I don't have enough time to play all the different games. You know, it's like, I'll admit my favorite fishing, I love a lot of it, right? And I've done saltwater fishing and everything else, but a day on a high mountain stream, where you're catching 12, 13 inch fish on a dry fly. And then every once in a while, there's a 16 or 17 inch fish mixed in and you're all alone, you know, 3, 4, 5 miles in the backcountry. That's a perfect day of fishing for me. And so everything else kind of stems from that core.
Yeah, that's good. Love that. Well, let's take it there, because I think we jumped right into it, but I'd like to hear your background. You obviously do some fly fishing. Take us to, like, first, you know, how'd you get into fly fishing? And then let's take it into the Henry's Fork Foundation and all that. But how'd you start? Have you been doing this a while?
You know, I grew up in Eastern Colorado, farm kid there. And so pheasant hunting and things like that, but honestly, not much water around if it didn't come from the Ogallala Aquifer, you know, out of the ground. And so we would take occasional trips to the mountains and, you know, started to build the love of fishing through that, or going to some of those, you know, impoundments on the South Platte, Lake McConaughey, and so forth, and doing stuff like walleye fishing and bass fishing. So started to build it that way. But it wasn't until I moved to Fort Collins, Colorado, from the very eastern part of the state, that in junior high, and I had a buddy and they had a cabin on the Coffalaputa River, and he introduced me to fly fishing. And, you know, I still remember the day we rode our bikes up and caught some fish, and we were, you know, we called them helgramites at that time, right? We were swinging stonefly nymphs is what we were doing, and catching some pretty decent brown trout, you know, up to 15, 16 inches on the lower Coffalaputa. And that was, you know, but I just learned from him, and we would fish ponds around Fort Collins. We'd get in our kick boats and, you know, float tubes and catch smallmouth bass and sunfish and bluegill and stuff. And that, but we would do it with spinning rods too. You know, we were opportunists. We would do whatever we thought was going to work best that day. So that's how I started fishing. And then, you know, had a career, graduated from Colorado State University in wildlife biology, but I did a bunch of work there through Kurt Fausch's lab at Colorado State University, worked on a PhD project. And I looked at Colorado cutthroat versus brook trout competition. And so I led a field crew there for a PhD student at CSU and spent a lot of time on backcountry creeks, setting up weirs and doing research, and moved on to other things, you know, running a bison ranch, working for Wyoming Game and Fish Department, but spent most of my career in the nonprofit world. And so worked a little bit for Pheasants Forever, spent 7 years with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, but now I've been here as the executive director at the Henry's Fork Foundation for, well, in my 12th year, I guess.
Wow. 12. Yeah. You got a nice, that's pretty awesome. Sounds like you've done a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I guess a little bit of breadth to the background. And I'll admit, you know, I mean, this job almost forces you to become more serious about your fly fishing, although I try to never get too serious, but definitely spent, you know, spent a lot of time now and have been fortunate through, you know, donor trips and building relationships with people to go to Chile and Argentina and Cuba and Alaska and do things I probably would have never done without being in this world. So
that's pretty cool. That's one of the benefits, right? Of the fact that that is part of it. Yeah. I mean, you're the person making connections, and some of the best ways to make connections is to get out on the water with these people and chat and do some trips. And I saw that you got, can't remember on your website somewhere where you're doing a couple of hosted trips coming up here. What do you guys have going? Is that something you're doing this year?
Yeah, I'll admit you caught me off guard there on that one. I don't have anything myself coming up. So if it's not my trip and it's some other staff member handling it, I don't pay quite as much.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you right now, it's this might be old. It's say the I don't know if these are older things, but it looks like, no, these are 23. So Las Pampas Lodge and Elk River, British Columbia. I don't know either of those. Actually, I've heard of them, but where is the... Sounds like that's pretty cool. Where is Las Pampas? Argentina.
Yeah, Las Pampas is down Rio Pico. So it's south of...
Oh, yeah, Rio Pico.
Yeah, and the owner of that lodge, right, this is just how these things happen, became a great friend of the foundation. I think we actually have... We put that trip on hold till next year just because sometimes it's hard to get enough people to go.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, that's a tough trip. Yeah, $6,300. I mean, and that sounds like a deal for that going way down there.
Yeah. And I did it last year with a big group of donors and it was fantastic. It's a great place. And even in a drought year, it was still fantastic. But yeah, I mean, that's those kinds of trips and building relationships that way. I mean, we've tripled our budget since I arrived in 2011. And a big part of that, of course, it's really good work, right? And mission accomplishment, and those things are happening. But it's building relationships with people and introducing them to our work and inviting them to invest in. Then because you have that relationship, and they see, you know, what you're doing, they want to invest in it. And so trip, yeah, sometimes those trips go really well as far as being able to get them sold and they're easy, and other times it's a struggle. And so we work with the shops on that. So we just push that one back a year. But it's a great place down there. I will say for myself, you know, the travel like that is that many hours of travel gets tough, right? It's just from Ashton, Idaho, it's, you know, 40 hours door to door there.
Oh, right. Yeah. What do you have to do from Ashton? You fly over. What's your connect? Well, yeah. Break it down real quick. What was your trip like? Where did you fly from Ashton?
Oh, so yeah. You know, it's drive to Idaho Falls. Sometimes it's Bozeman. Sometimes it's Salt Lake. Depends on what the flights look like. Right. And then into somewhere like Dallas or Houston, then into Buenos Aires, which, you know, you're flying all night to get there. And I heard now that they're actually going to start doing the regional flights out of Buenos Aires to the rest of the country. But previously you had to get a shuttle to the other airport, and I'm forgetting the names of the airport often. And so you're trying to get across town and match up schedules. And sometimes you have to stay overnight in BA. And then you find another 2-3 hours, you know, from Buenos Aires, maybe 4 hours to where you're going. And then you drive another 4 hours.
See, this is the crazy thing about me. This is where I think I'm the perfect person for this, because I talk to people that are just like, they say, they're like, oh man, it's terrible. But I actually love that. You know what I mean? Like, that just sounds like fun to me. For some reason, I love going into the airports and just the random stuff, because, you know, you're out there, you're just stopping in for like a half a day in some random town. And I don't know. I think I'm weird that way. Do you think most people probably like don't like that part of it?
You know, I don't know. The funny thing is, you know, for example, I headed out on a northeastern Montana pheasant hunting trip in December, and I love driving myself. I can drive myself. I just did 16 hours back from Oregon driving myself, right?
Damn. Straight?
Yeah. That is no bother to me, really. It's tiring, of course, but I don't mind that at all. Airports wreck me, right? And all those transfers, and probably I'm not a fluent Spanish speaker, so I, you know, there's a little stress involved with that too. And it,
yeah,
until I get there, I have that 40 hours is a bit tough for me. So, and I don't sleep well on airplanes. That's probably part of it. If I slept better on airplanes, that would help.
Yeah, well, the secret for me is I download a bunch of podcast episodes and I just listen to podcasts.
Perfect.
So there Perfect. You go. Well, let's circle back around. This has been a good little tangent. So looking back at what you guys have going, we're not going to be able to dig into everything, but, you know, give us a couple of highlights. Do you want to talk more about the South Fork Initiative, or what would you, if you want to leave somebody with a couple of things that we haven't covered here, what else would you tell us today?
Yeah, you know, I'd just say the South Fork Initiative is awesome, but it's kind of only one part of what we do, in a small part. Yeah, the focus, and this is really, you know, I'm kind of mentioned the Island Park Reservoir. That's what we focus on. So we have developed a precision management program that we work with the irrigators on. And since 2018, we've conserved about 25,000 acre feet a year, which an acre foot is a football field with about a foot of water.
Oh, wow.
The whole reservoir is about 135,000 acre feet. So 25,000 acre feet in that reservoir is pretty important. It's pretty substantial. And what that is it's carryover. We get to the end of the season, and versus what would have normally been in there based on past records, you know, prior to 2017, that's the amount of water we've been able to work with our partners and keep in the reservoir. And that just leads to a whole host of good things, a better winter flow, because you have a smaller hole to fill in the reservoir all winter long. And that winter fill and flow leads to increased, you know, fish population. It leads to better outcomes for water quality, just because you kind of have that deeper, more stable reservoir. I mean, there's a lot of technical stuff that goes into a lot, but that program is what right now is kind of what we're focused on, most proud of. There's all kinds of things going on around that, right? Like the precision management, we've done a bunch of research on the lower Henry's Fork and looking at how to optimize flows there to protect not only the lower Henry's Fork, but protect Island Park Reservoir and the ranch. That was a whole PhD project. We've also done a PhD project above Island Park Reservoir, coming from Big Springs, which is the large spring that supplies most of the water to the Henry's Fork coming off that Yellowstone country. You know, just this amazing amount of water, you know, pumping out of the ground every day, all day long. And so that stretch from there to the reservoir, and we've actually now shown through that PhD work that keeping Island Park Reservoir more full helps that fishery as well. So there's these multiple benefits by keeping more water in Island Park Reservoir. And honestly, the people that are managing water in the state of Idaho are taking notice, like, how do we take some of those precision management and predictive models, and how do we use those to the benefit of everyone here across Southern Idaho? So we're starting to see that happen a bit. That being said, you know, so here's this great work, right? 25,000 acre feet a year, year after year. We're only paying, you know, if you look at our entire budget, that's about $2.5 million annually. So we're paying about $100 an acre foot for this conserved water. You know, we're not leasing it. We're not buying it. In fact, in Idaho, we don't even have the legal opportunity to do that. But if you went to Colorado or California, where they do have the legal opportunity to do that, it would cost between $1,000 and $3,000 annually to lease or buy that water. So we're doing it way cheaper just through, you know, kind of science and collaboration and trust, right? Which is pretty cool to me. It doesn't mean it's not without its pitfalls, but it's a pretty cool deal. And you've heard about the Colorado River system, right? We've all seen that in the news with Lake Powell and Lake Mead. And if the percentages were the same down there for those reservoirs, you know, they're looking at evaporative losses of, you know, 1 million acre feet or right. Our program could cover that first evaporative loss for them if they ever got to the point where they could do something similar on that scale, but similar percentages. And so you look at it that way, you're like, oh, that is pretty impactful. What we're doing here percentage-wise is a lot of water. That being said, if you look back through all the water history, which we do all the time, right? We're just like farmers in the fact that we're always looking at water history and water flows and the weather and the weather today, right? And we can't always match up for the angler, for our member, their experience on a river, on this river, the South Fork, on a given day or even a given week, because sometimes things just work against you, right? It's just the weather, the heat, the wind. You know, this spring was super cold after a really light.
Right, lots of snow, right?
We didn't, you know, we were 28-29% down on our snowpack. So if you think of, we think here as, you know, average snowpack, 100% snowpack, but that's 100% in that case is still kind of like it's average, which averages a C. And so by the time you go, you know, you're way into the F range by the time you're 28% down from that. Now, if you can get up to, you know, 120% of average, okay, now you're in that A range as far as a snowpack. And we haven't been there much. In fact, in the last 20 years, we're in a long-term drought. There's only been a couple years that would get into that B to A range, a few C years, and a whole bunch of D and F years as far as, you know, looking at historical averages when it comes to, you know, watershed yield out of the Henry's Fork. And so we're just, and then in July 2020, an intermediate drought started, and this last, snowpack year kind of finished that off. Now, we did get some rain this summer, which helped take the edge off of it a little bit and alleviate, you know, that was June. And then again, in the fall, we got some moisture, but we went from this cold spring, which suppressed insect hatches and plant growth in the river and all of these processes to kind of July 1st, the light switch flipped. And then we ended up with 2.5 months of the hottest, driest weather we've ever had. And then you go back into, you know, it snowed. In fact, I just wrote all this for my piece in the annual report. It snowed here in Ashton. And on November 4th, my grass was covered and I haven't seen the grass since. Oh, and wow. So, you know, it's just this yo-yo. And I think that's the change, right? The climate change thing, if you talk about it here, even the farmers will say, and they'll be like, yeah, I just can't depend on things the way I used to. The variability is so much greater.
How do you guys do that with your thing? How do you guys, you know, as you look at that, because obviously there's some climate change, some things going on. When you look at it, it sounds like you got a successful program. Do you look ahead and think, well, this is potentially where we're going? I mean, how do you predict that stuff and what you're doing? How do you change your water work you're doing?
We definitely look into the future and look at strategies into the future. And in fact, it'll frustrate our membership sometimes because there's things that we're working on, like sediment mobilization in Island Park Reservoir. And that, right, if I went into that right now, I'd be going deeply into the weeds. It is having an impact. It's something that kind of with an aging reservoir is developing. Well, the solutions to that are really complex and they take a lot of partners, and I can't just come like openly talk about everything we're doing. All I can say is, hey, we're working on that. We've got some stuff in process, and there has to be a little bit of trust and belief that, yeah, we're truly doing these things. But it doesn't help that person out on the river that day that now he's got turbid water and he wanted to dry fly fish on the ranch. And now the fish aren't rising because the hatches have been suppressed because it's been dry for 20 years and there's turbidity and, you know, these things that are they're impacting it. And it's a tough story to tell that, hey, we're the Henry's Fork Foundation. We're doing this great work. What we're doing right now is making this situation way better than it would be. You know, we can show you how bad it'd be, but it's hard to even imagine how bad it'd be if we weren't doing what we're doing,
right?
You know, putting more winter flow in, a little less summer flow that, you know, that actually helps with kind of fishing conditions. You know, 1,000 more fish in the river than there would have been, but yeah, the population's still lower than it was 3 or 4 years ago because we don't have the winter flows that we had then. We're making an impact, but it's in, all it's doing is making a really bad situation just bad. So,
yeah, right. It's hard to look at it too, because you look at it and people want quick changes, you know, and some of this stuff is, it's a longer period, right? Some of this is going to take years and years to see, and especially with climate change, you know, who knows how long this is going to go on. And yeah, I think it's tough because people want quick wins, but you can't always get quick wins, right? You got to like convince them that, hey, this might take our lifetime to get there, right? So do you guys see that as kind of a education you have to talk about a little bit?
Oh yeah. Communication is essential for us. It's tough to hit the right notes on that all the time. We're continually working to get better, but yeah, that is a difficult concept there. And, you know, and someone will bring us an idea, well, let's dredge Island Park Reservoir and that'll take care of all the sediment issue. Okay. I see what you're saying, but as soon as you start to look at it, like the environmental processes and even some of our like other partner organizations would be like, no, we're never doing that because the impacts while it's being done will be so, you know, catastrophic. And then you throw on, I mean, now we've just for due diligence, right? We've kind of tracked that out. And if you're talking $500 million to $750 million, including the 10 years of NEPA and everything that would have to be done, the NEPA being the National Environmental Policy Act, you know, it's just, that's not really an option. It seems like, oh, this is so simple. We just suck this stuff out. And it turns out it's not a viable option. And it's actually not a cost effective. If I had $750 million, you know, to work on this problem, I'm not sure that would still be the thing I would do. There's some other really impactful things that could be done.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So we're working on other, you know, strategies that, but they're just going to take, all of them take time. These are not simple things. They're big projects and they're going to take a lot of groundwork to get put in place. And it's that part of us continually learning, right? When the reservoir was a younger reservoir and the dynamics in the reservoir were different and water management was different, we weren't seeing some of these sediment events the same. And so, you know, it's kind of we're making a lot of steps forward, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to be faced with new challenges as we make those steps forward. And we're definitely struggling with that. But I think we've got the right thoughts. It's just, we'll need our members to stick with us, right? You got to have that support. And I think we can eventually get there. Yeah. Hopefully it starts to snow a whole bunch more though in coming years. That would take the pressure off just a little bit.
Oh, right. Right. Exactly. More snow. Yeah. That's the one thing we don't know. You know, it's amazing because we definitely have no idea. I mean, you could do all your predictions, but at the end of the day, we don't totally know. And I think, like you said, the cool thing is, and that's why, you know, we love doing these, because it is all about the local groups. I feel like, you know, when you talk to some of these companies and supporters, they always say, like, you know, I always ask them, like, how can we do this? You know, what can we do? And they always say, support the local groups, because you guys are the ones on the ground that have your finger on the pulse. And if we can support you, then there's a better chance that we're going to have not only better fishing, but better everything, right? And that's kind of what it comes down to. Give us a heads up on everybody listening here right now that are still hanging in there on this. Where would we send them if they want to, like, you know, find out more, have an impact, maybe contribute to what you have going? What would you tell them?
Yeah, I would definitely get on our website, that www.henrysfork.org. You can look at reports. You can look at published papers. You can donate on there. And we'd love to have you donate and have, you know, a growing membership will make us a stronger organization as we work on all these issues. If we can say we have 3,000 members instead of 2,300, that's more powerful as we talk to our partners and the people we're working with. So yeah, we would love to have you at any level. And even if it's just getting on there and learning about what we're doing, but yeah, you can find us on there, and that has all the links to Instagram, Facebook, and other places to set up with us and be able to get constant information.
Oh, good. Good. And do you guys have like an email list people can sign up?
Yes, there's, in fact, yeah, if you sign up for a membership, you get on that. And then we also have Dr. Rob Van Kirk here, one of the West's, you know, foremost ecological modelers. And he does a daily water report, which even if you're not like from this area, it's just kind of cool to see, and understand what's going on in the region based on his water report. So, you can definitely get on that list too by contacting him via his email. So.
There you go. Yeah, this is perfect. I'm looking at it now. It looks like it's all set up perfectly. You got the different memberships from individual to family to Riverkeep. It's all totally reasonable, and all the way up to if you want to be a life member or the Green Drake Society. That's pretty cool. You receive the you got the G. Loomis on board. This is awesome. So cool.
Fly anglers are into, you know, into gear, and so we got to have some incentives with some of those.
That's right. That's right. Well, the interesting thing is, as we speak, right, this is why we connected. We're doing the same thing here, where we're doing a little bit of a giveaway promotion to not only, you know, build some buzz for kind of this cool trip, but also to support like what we have going here, you know, now with you guys. So I think it all comes around, you know, for me, it's about kind of supporting the local groups as well. So cool. Well, we'll do that. We'll send everybody out to henrysfork.org. And yeah, Brandon, definitely going to be excited to keep in touch with you and follow you guys on your newsletter and let everybody know what's going on. So appreciate all your time today.
I appreciate your time. And when you guys come out, I'd love to have dinner with you or something, hook up when you're out this direction. I'd love to meet you face to face.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. We'll look you up. But, until then, have a good rest of the, I guess, what are we at now? We're in the winter time. So we're going to be coming out. When does that come out? Give me the heads up. When do you, it almost feels like with climate change, like we talked, is different, but do you feel like there is a good break in winter where you're like, okay, it's going to be warm then? Or how's that look? Are you don't know.
When you live in Ashton and Island Park, even though there is climate change, you know, we're not seeing it the same way, right? Like right now I'm just putting my head down and trying to get through till April 1st, and maybe we'll start to feel a little relief then. So,
right. So you don't know. Yeah. It could snow like 5 feet tomorrow or next week.
Well, right now that's not the forecast. We would take that, honestly, just for the water component. Yeah. We would take it.
Awesome. All right, Brandon, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you, Dave.
So there it is, coming off the river. Had an amazing day, had some sunshine. It was just one of those epic trips. Parking the boat, coming back, and we're going to have a nice adult beverage. And we're back at the cabin. Maybe get a campfire going. This is a good ride. I appreciate Brandon for shedding some light on all the good work they have going. This is really what keeps all this great fishing going, the work here. And if you want to check out some of the show notes, wetflyswing.com/414. 414, you can find some of the stuff we talked about today, including some videos, some links to past episodes, and all the good stuff. Quick listener shout out before we get out of here. Joe Sindorf. Joe reached out to me on email. He fishes the tributary rivers of Lake Michigan. And we talked a little bit about Joe's interested in getting kind of more of a switch rod. We specifically talked about kind of Echo, Lampson. Shout out to Nick at Lampson and Echo as well. And you can't go wrong with either of those brands, top of the game for sure. And so hopefully, Joe, you picked up a rod, excited for that. We also have a couple of great episodes we did with Jeff Liskey if you want to find out some of the stuff he uses in some of the same rivers. Obviously, he's down a little bit south of you. But shout out all around. Thanks, Joe. If you want to get a shout out on this podcast, you can send me an email anytime, dave@wetflyswing.com. And I'll put together an episode for you, and I'll give you a shout out here on this podcast. If we haven't connected yet, this is the time right now. Send me an email or connect with me on social. All right, I'm going to leave you with a little shout out to this trip. If you haven't had a chance to sign up, this is super easy. The only thing I need is an email, a name, and you're entered to win this trip. It's about $6,000 worth of stuff. This is not only a trip we're giving away, but we're giving away a bunch of products. We're giving away a Shadow X Euro Nymphing Rod. We're giving away a Lampson Reel. We're giving away another rod. We're giving away waders. We got, you name it, this thing is loaded. And we got some great brands on board. So if you want to get a chance, real easy, go to wetflyswing.com/giveaway right now. Enter to win. And this is only going to be open for less than a week. So we're going to be open this thing quick. And like I said, if you want to jump in and just get one of the six slots, if they're still available right now, you can check in dave@wetflyswing. Send me an email and just say, hey, in the subject line, interested in the Euro nymphing trip, interested in catching big fish on the South Fork of the Snake, browns, rainbows. This is right at the back door of Yellowstone National Park. We're doing another one. This is like as big as it gets as far as I'm concerned. And that's our goal, is to get the best guides in the country, go to the best locations in the country, put together the best schools so you come away with some techniques that are going to last a lifetime in your home water. And so shout out to Pete Erickson. He's helping me put this this amazing trip together. And I am not going to bug you much longer on this, but just want to say do it right now. And I hope to see you on the water. All right. Well, I hope you're having a good afternoon. I hope you are having a good evening. And I hope wherever you are in the world that you are having a morning if it's morning. And I'm glad you came with me on this one to join me on this journey. And I'm excited to check in with you on the next episode. We got another big one coming this week. Some topics you probably haven't been thinking about. And a reel, I know for sure, a reel you likely have never seen in your life that is probably the most unique thing that you'll see all year. Check in this week on our next episode and find out what I'm talking about. We're going into some more product stuff, and I know you love the new and unique products, so we got it coming tomorrow. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.